Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What came first, the company as groundbreaking or the CEO as visionary? Where Apple goes now that Steve Jobs is gone for a while? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. And by PBS, presenting a look at the cutting edge, including cancer-fighting nanobots. Nova's Making Stuff, Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 18th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us. First of all, that nosedive that Apple shares took at the opening bell this morning. Company got most of that back in the course of the day once people had gotten their minds around the news about CEO Steve Jobs. Jobs, of course, announced yesterday he's taking his second medical leave in as many years for an indefinite period this time. Apple's profits announced after the bell this afternoon should put to rest any immediate fears about the company's fate. Those numbers blew past already high expectations. And really, no wonder. Its phones and iPads have redefined what it means to be mobile. The company's sitting on a $50 billion pile of cash. And yet, with or without Steve Jobs, Apple is going to be facing some challenges, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
In the 18 months since Steve Jobs returned from a liver transplant, he's knocked a lot of items off Apple's to-do list. The iPad, the Mac App Store, the Beatles on iTunes, the iPhone on Verizon.
I think the story of Apple since the introduction of the iPhone has been basically initiating the post-PC world.
Yari Rayner is a tech analyst at Oppenheimer Securities. He says Apple's created a series of beautiful, easy-to-use devices that put the internet in your pocket. Apple's hooked us into Google Maps, Netflix, and millions of apps. And Rayner says this has changed computing, the internet, and how we live, maybe forever.
Now that Apple has started that new revolution, the challenge will be maintaining the value from here on out.
So what will it take for Apple to continue to thrive with or without Steve Jobs? Rayner thinks the company should create services to compete with the Googles and the Netflix of the world. But most analysts disagree, like Bill Fernley at Cheney Capital.
I think the big thing with Apple is continue with the product innovation that they've done on multiple products.
Innovations that surprise us. Create products that millions instantly lust after, even if they didn't know they wanted or needed them ahead of time. Fernley says Apple's genius hasn't been creating totally new technologies. What Apple's done is to take ideas that have been around for a while, like MP3 players or smartphones, and refine them, make them easy to use and understand and desire. If Apple can continue to do that, Fernley says the company has nothing to worry about. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Apple shares closed down just a couple of percent today. You can check out our chart of Apple's product releases and executive changes against its stock price on our website, marketplace.org. By the way, the iPhone, not that big a bump, in case you were thinking. So in between getting ready for Chinese President Hu Jintao's visit and thinking about the State of the Union speech next week, President Obama found some time this morning to do some paperwork. He ordered a review of federal regulations to ensure they don't stifle economic growth. He wants to get rid of rules that might be old or unnecessary or are, in his words, just plain dumb. For small businesses, though, from whence this economy gets most of its new jobs, it's not just federal regulations that are the issue. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Just like taxes, regulations vary from state to state, and even from county to county. And not surprisingly, they can outlive their relevance.
We, for a long time in Ohio, still had on the books regulations that governed how you hitched up horses in front of businesses.
Roger Geiger is with the Ohio chapter of the National Federation of Independent Business. He says even existing rules can be silly. He knows a company that was fined for hanging fire extinguishers a few inches too low. It's especially hard for small businesses because they don't have the large compliance departments to help them deal with the rules. And the rules are often one size fits all, whether you're a major car maker or a local parts supplier.
Do we create a rule for the General Motors and expect them to be able to comply the same way we want Vermeer Auto Parts Store to comply with? There's very, very differing environments there, and there needs to be sometimes flexibility, particularly for small businesses.
For small companies, onerous local regulations can force business decisions. Susan Miskin is president of a junkyard in Minnesota. She says expensive workers' compensation insurance is the biggest reason she hasn't added to her 12-person workforce.
It is just sky high here. Again, triple what Iowa pays. I bet you it's probably 10 times what South Dakota has to pay.
States are starting to realize that they have to cut red tape, too, to spur their economies. Ohio's new governor is already reviewing and revising its rules to eliminate redundant ones and bring them more in line with his plans to create more jobs. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
After taking last week to mark the events in Houston, the House of Representatives started its debate on repealing the health care law today. The bill is not going anywhere in the democratically controlled Senate, but the discussion is a start for the GOP and what it's really trying to do. Go after the healthcare law bit by bit. From Washington, Marketplace's Dave Gura takes a look.
I asked Thomas Scully to handicap tomorrow's repeal vote. He ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for President George W. Bush.
I don't think repeal is going to succeed, but I do think there'll be a lot of efforts at modest rollbacks, delays of some of the spending and other things over the next couple of years, and eventually I think some of them will succeed.
He says later this week, opponents will go through the whole law looking for ways to change it. Henry Aaron is with the Brookings Institution. He predicts lawmakers will propose several discrete bills in both houses of Congress, based on what they've heard from constituents and lobbyists.
And a bill as large and complicated as the health care reform bill is, there are individual provisions that are more popular, and there are some that are less popular.
So, what are they going to target?
The ones that strike me as in most serious jeopardy are those relating to the requirements that people do certain things.
Require people to buy insurance, require businesses to insure workers. But Aaron says opponents could let the courts decide those issues and try another approach.
What one might call the 1,000-cut strategy.
They could tie up funding by arguing the deficit prevents more spending, Scully says. They could end up saying,
when the deficit gets under 3% of GDP or 4% or 5%, then we'll start handing out the goodies.
But is there a risk here for opponents that by going through the law again with a fine-toothed comb, they could improve it and make it harder to repeal down the line?
You can debate whether it's better or worse. It certainly would be politically more defensible.
Scully says parts of the law don't take effect till January 2014, and there's a big election before then. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, just one word, up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The phrase good corporate citizenship carries with it a fairly broad definition, at least in the minds of a lot of consumers. It means helping out in local communities. It means protecting the environment. It means any one of a number of other things that people can think to hang on that label. In the law, definitions can be a bit more specific. A year ago, the Supreme Court gave corporate citizenship a very specific meaning. Companies have the right, as do regular citizens who can walk and talk, to contribute to political candidates for federal office. Tomorrow, the justices consider a case brought by the phone giant AT&T that could affect a company's right to personal privacy. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
In 2004, the FCC investigated an AT&T government contract to provide cheap internet access to schools. A year later, AT&T's competitors used the Freedom of Information Act to access the documents the FCC had gathered. The FCC said fine, after stripping out what it considered corporate secrets. But AT&T sued to block release of the documents. It argued the Freedom of Information Act exempts information that invades personal privacy. Jeff Kleinberg will argue AT&T's case before the Supreme Court tomorrow. He says the company is trying to prevent the release of potentially disparaging documents.
Corporations have an interest in protecting their reputations, and the use by, a competitor, for example, as is true in this case, of potentially harmful documents. AT&T is saying about you, Mr. Customer. Come with us instead.
Kleinberg says the Freedom of Information Act wasn't designed to give corporate competitors access to private information.
I mean, recall, FOIA is about learning what the government is up to, as the court has said many times. It's not a mechanism for learning about corporations.
But a large number of news organizations are opposing AT&T's claim of personal privacy. Lucy Dalglish is with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She says businesses routinely use FOIA to learn about competitors.
The Freedom of Information Act does not say who gets to get information held by the government. Sometimes competitors get it. Sometimes people who don't like you seek information about you. There is nothing in the law that says you have to ask someone why they want the information when they ask for it.
But companies are used to being treated legally as people. The government protects them from unreasonable searches and seizures, for example. The Business Roundtable's Maria Ghazal hopes tomorrow's case will clearly establish a corporate right to personal privacy as well.
Something that you wouldn't necessarily want your competitors or other companies to know that's more personal to your company. It's not necessarily under the category of a proprietary secret, but it's what you feel is something that should stay within the company.
Businesses take heart from last year's Citizens United case. That's where the justices gave companies the same right as individuals to participate in political campaigns. They're hoping the justices are ready to expand that right. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I don't know if you've been following the discussion that's been out there the past week or so about a book written by a Chinese-American woman named Amy Chua. It's about the differences, the very big differences, between Western and Asian styles of parenting. Suffice it to say that Amy Chua is a strict mom. A's are the only grade that's acceptable. 3 hours of piano practice every day is enough, but just barely, that kind of thing. Anyway, I've been racking my brain trying to find a marketplace angle to this thing. Commentator and educator Michelle Rhee says it's all marketplace.
We've lost our competitive spirit. We've become so obsessed with making kids feel good about themselves that we've lost sight of building the skills they need to actually be good at things. I can see it in my own household. I have 2 girls, 8 and 12, and they play soccer. And I can tell you that they suck at soccer. They take after their mother in athletic ability. But if you were to see their rooms, they're adorned with ribbons, medals, and trophies, you'd think I was raising the next Mia Hamm. I routinely try to tell my kids that their soccer skills are lacking and that if they want to be better, they have to practice hard. I also communicate to them that all the practice in the world won't guarantee that they'll ever be great at soccer. It's tough to square this, though, with the trophies. And that's part of the issue. We've managed to build a sense of complacency with our children. Take as a counterpoint South Korea, where my family is originally from. In Korea, they have this culture that focuses on always becoming better. Students are ranked 1 through 40 in their class, and everyone knows where they stand. The adults are honest with kids about what they're not good at and how far they have to go until they're number one. Can you imagine if we suggested anything close to that here? There would be anarchy. There are many nations who have figured out what works in education. Look at Singapore. Last summer, I heard the Prime Minister give a speech in which he outlined the plan for making Singapore number one in the world financially. His economic plan was rooted in education. He knows that if the country can make its education system the best in the world, that economic success will follow. That's the opposite of what we do here in America. We see education as a social issue, not an economic one. And what happens to social issues in times of economic hardship? They get swept under the rug. We need to change our national conversation on education and our national culture on how we encourage kids. I think what's becoming clear with all of this is that if we don't start to shift our perspective, we'll never regain our position in the global marketplace.
Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of the public school system in Washington, D.C. Now she runs Students First. That's an educational advocacy organization. Send us your thoughts about education policy or anything else you hear on the broadcast. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, consumer power.
A bad review could cost you $10,000 a month. A few bad reviews can put you out of business.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 50 points, 0.4% today, closed at 11,837. The NASDAQ put on 10 points, about a 1/3%, 2765. At the bell, the S&P 500 ticked up a point, a 1/10%, ended things at 1295. Financial stocks had a down day. Citigroup plunged nearly 6.5% today after reporting weak quarterly profits. Profits, but weak. Bank of America dipped 1 2/3%. Goldman Sachs not looking so golden, was down 0.2%. JPMorgan Chase reversed 0.3% today. The big story today was technology. Apple, as we mentioned, crushed every expectations. Its shares were down 2.25 points during the regular session after falling nearly 8% yesterday overseas. Apple shares shot up in trading after the bell, though. IBM also announced higher than expected profits. Its shares were up after the bell as well. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions since 1896. Allianzusa.com. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Is there building going on in your neighborhood? The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for December. President Obama hosts Chinese President Hu Jintao at the White House for an official state visit. And matchmakers and social media executives gather in Miami to focus on the business of online dating. The 3-day conference iDate 2011 begins. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Being a venture capitalist seems like a fairly daring thing to do. You invest in generally untested but potentially promising ideas, and if they fail, that's it. You're done. No money back guarantee, no nothing. William Draper got into the game a while ago, 1959 to be precise. He was one of the first VCs on the West Coast up in Silicon Valley. And back then, it really was daring because nobody had ever heard of it.
We used to go out and knock on doors and say, we've got some money. What's venture capital? Well, we'll just take a piece of the company and you keep running it. And, you know, that was a new concept out here in 1959.
William Draper's written a book about his experience and about the relationship between capitalist and entrepreneur. It's called The Startup Game. Bill Draper, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You know, you hear the term venture capital, and most people probably think two things. One is money, obviously, but the other one is technology. Everybody thinks venture capital and technology somehow go together. What is your take on what venture capitalists do?
I think most of the venture capital operations are focused on technology. I think that's true. But money is a very minor part of the total package because there's a lot of support, a lot of team building, a lot of organization and relationships between entrepreneurs and venture capitalists that are key in making a successful startup.
Another way to say that is you guys don't want to just hand over your money. You want to have a role in this business that you're choosing to help get off the ground.
We do, but only if it's a positive influence. There are times when you're glad your advice isn't taken, but you're right, you're happy to be heard.
You know, there's a great line somewhere in this book, and you said, you know, there was some money chasing a good idea. I always thought entrepreneurs looked at venture capital the other way, as a good idea chasing some money.
Well, it all depends. In this case, it happened to be Yahoo. We knew it was a very brilliant breakthrough in technology, and so we were eager to make the investment. We got outbid, and that was one of the ones that got away. There's no venture capitalist that gets them all, and I'm the first to admit that I've lost a lot. Skype was my latest lucky break.
The internet phone company, right?
That's right. The internet phone company. Everybody uses it to, I think 500 million people are using Skype today.
How do you know a great idea when you hear one.
I take a long look at the individual and make sure that person has done his homework or her homework before I back the idea, because I figure that they're going to live with this. If they haven't really done a thorough investigation, then I want to know that at the beginning.
Can we get by without venture capital, though? I mean, you know, you can go to other investors and you can go to the stock market and stuff and get some money.
Oh, no, 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 no. Facebook couldn't go to a bank and get a commercial loan to start up a company. And small companies shouldn't borrow money because they don't have the equity to support it. So this is all equity. The venture capital money is all common stock and preferred stock. Venture capital would be the only place, other than angels, who wealthy individuals who might back it, or friends and family that get it started. You know, that's a seed round, and then eventually you need some strong venture capitalists to support it.
I was about to ask you if you're optimistic about the state of the American economy, but it sort of seems to me that if you are in the business you're in of providing money to companies as they start up, you have to be an optimist.
Well, I'm still young, so therefore, I'm very optimistic about the future and expect it to be better than ever. And I think technology is the place to put your venture capital for sure, because we've just had tremendous breakthroughs on ideas, and they're coming faster all the time. Machines are talking to machines, and the speed is so dramatic that you'll have some major breakthroughs if you play the game with diversification. You can't focus on just one company and hope that it will be the builder of your fortune.
Bill Draper, longtime venture capitalist up in Silicon Valley. He's got a new book out. It's called The Startup Game. Mr. Draper, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
We've got an excerpt of The Startup Game on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. The thing about the internet age is that there's no place to hide. Even if you opt out of Facebook or you don't tweet, it's still not going to be all that hard to find out about you online. The same is true, to their occasional chagrin, for businesses. All the service and product review sites out there have given consumers a way to fight back against corporate America, or praise it, as the case may be. And the government is stepping in. The Consumer Product Safety Commission opened a registration for an online database of consumer complaints today, as Sally Herships reports.
James Lindsay and his son Hawken own Hawken's Hall, a restaurant and bar in Manhattan. Like any other business owners, the Lindsays appreciate word of mouth. Their restaurant has almost 60 reviews on Yelp and 3.5 stars. But Hawken Lindsay says there is a downside. Amateur reviews aren't always thoughtfully written, especially the bad ones.
I didn't like the way the waitress looked, or one of our bartenders being kind of an older guy.
The restaurant cost almost $2 million to open a couple years ago, but it hasn't turned a profit yet. So the Lindsays are doing everything they can, including paying attention to online reviews.
A bad review could cost you $10,000 a month. A few bad reviews can put you out of business. Your whole investment is down the drain.
It is not uncommon that if we're in a dispute with a customer, they'll tell you, you're going to hear about this on Yelp.
And that's just your typical consumer reviewer. Then there are the big guns, bloggers, like Heather Armstrong. She's a mom blogger in Salt Lake City, Utah. A couple years ago, she and her husband had a new baby and a new $1,300 Maytag washing machine
that broke within 3 or 4 weeks of purchase.
Armstrong says sometimes it worked, but most of the time she just got an error message.
When you have a newborn child, there's a lot of dirty clothing. So it was an awful mess that I didn't want to live in anymore.
Armstrong did everything an appliance owner is supposed to. She had a 10-year warranty. She'd called customer service, even corporate headquarters. But after almost 3 months, she decided she'd had enough. So she hit the Twitter site and started typing in all caps.
And said, don't ever buy a Maytag washing machine. Our Maytag washing machine is broken. Someone's been out to fix it 3 times and it's still not working.
Here's what you need to know. Armstrong has 1.5 million followers on Twitter. Do you think you were Maytag's worst nightmare that day?
Yeah, I do.
And a couple days later, her machine was finally fixed.
Maytag wouldn't talk to me on the phone, but the company emailed to say the experience helped improve its online customer service. For businesses right now, the landscape of online reviews can feel like the Wild West.
Except instead of carrying a Smith & Wesson or a Remington, you're carrying a blog.
David Lazarus is consumer columnist at the Los Angeles Times.
There are many, many corporate executives whose job it is, among other things, to monitor these sites, look at what's being said, and respond.
But now, the sheriff is coming to town. Well, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. Today, the commission is starting a soft launch of its new online product safety database. It's not for product reviews. The database will only list product recalls and complaints about safety and health hazards.
The business world is freaked out because they see this as a potential dumping ground for any sort of gripe a consumer can muster.
And remember, that complaint would be listed on an official government site. But the content will still be written by consumers. So what should businesses do when faced with bad feedback online? Angie Hicks is founder of Angie's List, a service review site for consumers. Hicks says no one likes criticism. So if you're a business on the receiving end of some, the first thing to do is take a break.
Don't just instantly respond, because sometimes your first instinct is not going to be your best instinct.
Next, she says, focus on criticism you can actually do something about, which is what restaurant owners James and Hawk and Lindsay are doing. They're renovating, getting rid of table service, and only serving food at the bar or counters. It's expensive, but they hope the changes they're making will help them cut down on bad reviews. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today to follow up on our story last week about systemic risk, the idea that the government's going to be paying extra special attention from now on to companies that are too big to fail. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is chairing the Financial Stability Oversight Council, as we mentioned, which met today to figure out how to identify those firms that are TBTF. They're going to look at a company's size, how dominant it is, its interconnectedness, its use of leverage or debt, how much cash it has on hand, and how much oversight there is of it by federal regulators. Here's my question. After 2 years of financial crisis and all we've been through, we needed a special government commission to tell us that that stuff's important? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. The Dow picked up 50 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ put on 10 points, about 0.3%. The S&P 500 ticked up 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here.
Our days as a place where people have to go to get gambling are over.
Reinventing Atlantic City on the broadcast tomorrow. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.